Every American child should be able to grow up in a safe community, to attend a great school, and to have access to a high-paying job.
Welcome to Pod Save Education. I'm Taylor.
I'm Margo.
I'm Hannah.
And I'm Jenna. Each episode, we'll consider the state of education in Trump's America.
We're diving deep into our nation's political and cultural landscape and examining how the election of 2016 continues to shape key issues in the field of education.
Together, we'll look at the evolving educational issues of teacher diversity, rural education, campus sexual assault, and school climate.
We hope that our discussions spark further conversations on some salient issues regarding education and the current administration, and we're glad you're here. So my name is Taylor, and on today's episode of Pod Save Education, I'm going to look at rural education, specifically the changing demographics of rural communities, the key issues facing rural schools, and how President Trump's proposals will affect students in some of our neediest areas. I'll start with some background on rural education, and then my classmates and I will discuss President Trump's voucher plan and the general state of rural education in America. So why my focus on rural schools? It really starts in the fall of 2014. After I graduated college, I taught for 2 years at a small rural elementary school in Lamar, South Carolina, called Spalding Elementary. I watched as my 50 students grew over those 2 years, and they grew as learners and as individuals, and being their teacher brought me joy like I'd never known. But it also introduced me to a world of inequity that I'd never before experienced. And I want to dive a little deeper into those inequities faced by rural schools and students. News outlets like The Washington Post, New York Times, and CNN have proclaimed that rural America lifted Donald Trump to the presidency. And it's true. Rural communities overwhelmingly voted for our current president. They bought into his promises to create jobs and strengthen our country's borders. Yet, in many pockets of the country, rural America looks very different from those communities visited by our current president on the campaign trail. And while most face the common problem of fading job opportunities in an increasingly technological world, diverse rural communities also face a host of unique and different problems. First, a little bit about trends and demographics of rural schools. Although student populations continue to grow in urban and suburban districts, one out of five students in our country still attends a rural school. But rural districts make up over 50% of school districts nationwide. So why so many districts for only 20% of the nation's students? There's a few reasons. In 1940, there were over 100,000 school districts in the United States, many of which often had only one or two schools. As the decades went on, most of these districts consolidated to save money, and today the U.S. has around 14,000 districts. For many rural districts, however, consolidation wasn't and still isn't always feasible or wanted. Consolidation often means lost jobs for teachers and staff, something that communities with already high unemployment want to avoid. Rural districts also often cover large geographic areas, making consolidation a logistical challenge for student bus transportation. So now that we've addressed the number of rural districts, I want to offer some background on rural demographics. If you've pictured the rural student population as overwhelmingly white, you'd be right, in some states. In reality, the racial makeup of rural schools is a bit more complicated. So nationally, students of color make up approximately a quarter of the rural school population. But if you break those percentages down by state, some stark divides appear. Almost 70% of all rural minority students are found in just 13 states, and nearly all of those states are found in either the Deep South or the West. And rural districts with the highest poverty rates are also more likely to have schools where students of color make up a majority of the population. So all of this to say, rural communities in some states are very different than the picture painted of rural, white, Midwestern America. So let's bring this back to Trump. During the 2016 race, Trump's main education proposal revolved around a single key issue, school vouchers. His plan called for $20 billion to expand school choice through vouchers, an incredible sum of money. Trump's 2018 budget proposal is a little more modest. It calls for $250 million towards the study and expansion of school choice vouchers. Now, while Trump's voucher plan may benefit choice proponents in urban and suburban districts, it's unworkable for a large majority of the country. Researchers at the Center for American Progress estimate that vouchers are either logistically impossible or very difficult in 85% of school districts in the country. So I want to explore this voucher plan and just talk a little bit more about rural schools in general with my classmates. So here we've got Jenna, Hannah, and Margot. You guys excited to chat today?
So happy to be here.
I feel like I have so many questions about rural education. It's just something that you really don't think about.
Yeah, I always kind of like to frame it as rural students sometimes are the forgotten students because so many of our policies and discussions nationally or like on the state level deal with students in cities or in the suburbs.
And I feel like even if they don't directly say this policy is for students in suburbs or cities, we have these overarching policies that are supposed to cover rural students, but they just don't.
Right.
And I'm intrigued by what you mentioned about what poverty looks like in rural districts, because I think, you saw this in the campaign debates, presidential debates, you see this in our conversations we have in class, almost at every level we kind of, particularly in education, but also I think across the board in a lot of policies, we use poverty as this kind of proxy word for urban and for racial minorities. Those kind of all, you know, policies affecting one are targeted at all of them. And so I'm curious if you could speak to a little bit, like, how does poverty look different in rural districts than in urban ones? Like, it does that same, you know, those links that we make between those three words, clearly urban is not relevant to rural education, but how, you know, do we see those same links between interpreting poverty as racial minorities in rural? How does that look different?
Yeah, so one thing that's a big difference when it comes to poverty between rural and urban communities is the idea of persistent poverty. So under the Obama administration, the Department of Ed looked at communities that had been listed as having poverty levels at or above 20% since the 1980 census. And they found about a little over 300 communities that were in persistent poverty for those past over 30 years. 20 of those areas were metro areas and cities, but 300 were rural counties. Wow. So what that's basically saying is that, like, poverty, there are some metro areas where poverty's always been a struggle, but it's often kind of a shifting landscape. Whereas with rural communities, I mean, you have entrenched poverty among families for generations. And it often isn't by color in the same way that we think with like urban communities, because there is such a high like white population in rural communities. But like I said earlier, if you have a rural community in poverty, or like high levels of student poverty, like usually those schools have more minority students than rural schools with low levels of poverty. That's especially true when you think about the Deep South, where a lot of the like racial makeup of schools in the Deep South are students of color. And I want to actually throw that back. Jenna and I talked about this earlier. Jenna, describe for me like what you think of when you think of rural in Western Massachusetts, where you're from, or like the North in general.
Yeah, so a little context. I'm from Western Massachusetts, and we have a lot of small towns, a lot of rural New England areas. But I think that my conception of rural schools growing up was very different than I think what you've been describing in the rural South. For one thing, in Western Mass, it is primarily a white population. So you don't see those racial and economic divides on those lines. I'd say definitely probably lower poverty in some of the rural areas, but that's not an across the board in Western Mass. It's probably a little bit higher income. And I think one thing that I think about with our rural schools is actually an issue of jobs in our area. Or I guess I should say lack thereof jobs. That's a really big issue in my area, is that We have some really great schools and we're educating our students to a high level. But what ends up happening is they're leaving these areas because they're not near cities. There's no jobs. We used to have General Electric used to be in our town, and they moved out about 15 years ago. And they were the primary holder of all jobs for people. So our kids are leaving. I'm an example. I left and here I am in Nashville now, and I'm not going back to my town to work because there aren't jobs there for me to have. So we actually have our over 65 population has far outpaced our under 18 population, particularly lacking in people ages 20 to 40. There just aren't jobs to keep us. And I guess I'm wondering, to throw it back to you, Taylor, if is that something you see that's common in rural areas, that people are leaving those areas because there aren't jobs, or are people still staying in the areas?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a mix. Like, that issue of lack of jobs is really the what binds so many rural communities together, regardless of the demographics of those communities. They've done studies the past few years that show that rural communities are actually, like, achievement-wise among students, are becoming more in line with achievement you see in suburban and urban districts. Like, they're rising. But the number of students who get post-secondary education isn't rising at those same levels. And it's just like what you said, there just aren't opportunities. I always think back to, like, my own students in Lamar. The closest, like, post-secondary opportunity they had was a technical college that we actually got to visit when my first year teaching. But it was 25 miles away, which isn't a huge distance. But when you have young students who rarely leave a community, 25 miles is a pretty long distance to think about, like, your first and best option at post-secondary education. And in some parts of South Carolina, like, you know, it's up to 50 or 60 miles away from even a technical college, much less like a four-year institution.
That's what I kind of immediately thought, Jenna, when you brought that up, in terms of job availability and people leaving, is that education plays such a vital role in that, in kind of creating these huge divides between students in a rural school who will go into college and students who won't. You know, you think there's certainly huge divides across the board for the students that achieve, you know, go on to get a post-secondary education, and those that don't, but I can certainly imagine, you know, just the very stark distinctions in terms of where you live and what you can do in rural schools has got to be, you know, you even just conceptually very, very different, because you have to change everything about your life in a lot of these very remote rural places to even just access, to even just be in a place where there is the possibility of attending a post-secondary institution. You can't continue to live as in
right.
the community that you're already in.
Yeah.
And which is not, certainly not to say that there aren't huge barriers for students in urban schools, but that usually may not be one of them.
Right. Yeah. And you look at, you know, some people are optimistic about how you can use, like, virtual schooling, either at, like, K-12 or post-secondary, to bridge those gaps. But the reality is that, like, virtual schooling quality wise has not caught up anywhere near to like the quality of actually attending a good K-12 school or, like, a good college.
I have a question in there that you may or may not be able to answer. I can't say I watched it, unfortunately, but I saw an advert for a documentary on, I can't remember what it was called, but essentially on communities without access to the internet.
Hmm. Yeah.
And kind of how that is, I mean, this documentary series was really highlighting that, and I certainly, that was not something that I had thought about. I don't know if you would ask me if I thought there were communities here, I would have probably said, like, yeah, sure, but, you know, essentially not giving them a lot of importance. And so there was this program that I just saw advertised that was really emphasizing, you know, showing students and families and you know, how those students, how constrained they are by simply lack of access to an internet connection.
Yeah, they estimate that there are millions of students that don't have stable internet access at school or at home. I think about the middle school that we were connected to. They have an iPad program where every student gets an iPad. And they use it during school and they return it during the day, which makes sense that you don't have, like, a bunch of middle school kids taking iPads home. But also part of that is because a lot of them don't have internet access at home. So a lot of the ways they would use the iPad for, like, educational purposes, like, just can't be done. Mm. So I thought, you know, if I were a middle school teacher, like, there are actually probably some cool ways I could get, like, do homework assignments or, like, out of classroom work on these iPads.
Yeah.
That just aren't a reality when you know that a majority of your students are going back to a house without internet access.
So I found the place where I found this. It was on EdWeek, so that makes me feel good.
Yes.
But it's called Without a Net, the Digital Divide in America. Mm. And It's about the digital divide in the United States, specifically in high-poverty schools and high-poverty students. It is produced by Verizon, so...
So maybe Verizon is like coming out.
They well, certainly have an agenda to push.
Right. And I wrote actually my blog post about this for Bellwether over the summer. There are some school districts that are doing some rural ones that are doing some interesting things to kind of bridge this gap. One thing, and I don't want to get like too deep into this because it's kind of in the weeds with like federal policy, but basically in the 80s they gave like the bandwidth internet infrastructure control to school districts through legislation. But then school districts had the opportunity to like basically sell off this like internet capacity to private companies. Oh. So a lot of school districts did it because it was the 80s, you know, you don't really have a need for this, and money, like capital, is always a lot better than like holding on to this. Mm-hmm. But there are a few rural places where they never did this. And so now some school districts are actually able to work with like local cell towers and like basically building up some of the material infrastructure and taking back this essentially free internet to be used, not just at the school, but like with the community as a whole.
Wow.
So that's really interesting.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
It's so niche.
So yeah, it is. And it's not possible in a lot of places because a lot of school districts sold theirs off. But in the places that didn't, or where like the lease is about to expire, like that could be something that brings it community-wide that's kind of interesting. And so I want to just talk a little bit, thinking about framing this with our like current context and like thinking about something like vouchers or something like what Trump proposes. Because obviously it's just not something that's going to work in rural communities where you already only have a few schools. You know, the idea is if you have vouchers, then maybe high quality charters or private schools will kind of pop up to like accept these vouchers and fill that gap, which may be a reality like in a place like Nashville or outside of here, mm-hmm. but in rural districts, you just don't have the student population to do it. And it would likely force public schools to close. So I think that's like one big issue, thinking about how his policy might affect students. And another thing, so he has this quote that I will play for you guys.
But millions of African Americans in our inner cities remain trapped in poverty, joblessness, and failing schools. And these are the worst schools you'll ever see.
So I want to think about with this Trump quote, like how, what does this say about the relationship between race and like his idea of vouchers and school choice? Because his rhetoric around vouchers is like very targeted as like, we are helping poor African Americans. So have you guys, what do you think about that? Like, have like Hannah, especially with you thinking about this school choice thing, like, have you seen that in your own research looking at this? And like, what do you think? Do you think that hurts the conversation?
Yeah, totally. I was actually just having a conversation with someone from Denver 2 days ago about how there really needs to be a major shift in separating how we talk about school choice into talking about vouchers and then the expansion of charter, high quality charters, mm-hmm. because simply of what you're talking about, of vouchers being not really widely supported in the education reform community, specifically with regards to how it would impact rural education, and how it seems to be just a proxy for trying to address inequities for poor Black children.
Right.
And so, you know, what do we do with that? So I think I don't really have an answer other than I think more people are going to be wanting to participate in the conversation as soon as we continue to like move away mm-hmm. from the discussion of reform being in the form of a voucher.
Yeah. And I think there's also this sense of like, you know, the point of all of these, it's kind of like we need to help save these like minority groups. And then framing it as like, you know, white people that live in the suburbs or in rural communities, like they're fine. Mm-hmm. When like the reality is that a lot of failing schools are in rural communities, both communities of color and communities that are overwhelmingly white. But it's almost like there is a distrust that like cities in particular that have like high minority populations can handle it on their own. Mm-hmm. Whereas there is a trust given to like rural communities of like, they know what they're doing, which I think you see beyond education. I mean, I think you see it as like, oh, like rural America knows what they're doing, but like we need to come in and help with like cities or like people of color because they don't.
Well, and I think when you talk about the concept of innovation, you think of a city, you know, you're thinking of like hustle bustle, like
human capital.
And like people who are currently investing these initiatives or foundations or this like type of philanthropy, you know, they want to see a return on their investment, and doing it at a larger scale is much more attractive than, and you know, they might just not know about investment in a rural community. Now, I think the potential I see in this is tying together what you and Jenna were saying about job creation, especially in Appalachia when we're talking about, you know, all of these coal mining industries that just no longer mm-hmm. exist anymore in the high levels of poverty. And then seeing that as an investment or an idea, like perhaps that's a way to entice the innovation and reform communities to focus their efforts more on rural education, away from this voucher idea that will be detrimental to students.
Yeah, for me, it comes back to what I see as just a lack of information and a lack of voice from the correct people. Like, yeah. I will say I personally have a lot of difficulty taking some of Trump's comments seriously because, I mean, you think about who his base was and who the people were that were voting for him, and for him to come out and promote charters, I read that more as kind of his ignorance as what that policy really is rather than representing his base.
Yeah.
And so, but those ideas certainly are there. Like, Trump is not the only person saying this. Trump is not the only decision maker pushing vouchers in the educational field. And I think what we have a lack of people from rural communities that have a voice to come out and to make policy and to make change. I mean, we have, you know, Betsy DeVos of the Department of Ed, not from a rural environment, also very much pushing vouchers as a way to fix these issues that she very obviously has no experience of. And so it's hard for me to talk about these issues because I feel like the figureheads like Trump and DeVos that are pushing this, like their kind of separation from the issues is so very obvious that it's almost hard for me even to take what they're saying seriously. Yeah. But I know that like that, I mean, that same sentiment, the same emphasis on vouchers, it is not coming, they are not in a vacuum. Like, this is part of a party-wide, or, you know, bipartisan even focus on this, but there is very much still a kind of a black hole of voices from rural communities.
Yeah, saying, and I think
we face these same issues. Here's how this won't help us, so we need to think of something new. And I think you just don't hear that being said because policymaking happens in a state. And we see it, what we mentioned at the beginning of this episode. We see that replicating now, even in our coursework. We don't talk about rural education.
Yeah. Yeah.
All of our policy conversations are centered around policies that affect urban and suburban districts.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, so I just think it's so interesting thinking about all of this together and thinking about how rural America, you know, went so overwhelmingly for Trump last year, but yet when you turn to the education conversation, how little he has to offer them.
Yeah.
You know, I think we're going to reach a point where like that, that just becomes more apparent to those voters. I hope, but maybe not.
I think we all hope.
All right. Well, thank you guys for chatting with me about this interesting topic today. And hopefully we maybe over the next few months might see some rural voices magnified in this voucher conversation.
Thanks, Taylor.
Thanks, Taylor.